I'm going to do this a little different than I do the other programs I do. I will be reading a lot of the quotes from the official records at the spot I think they happened. Normally, as those of you who have had me before, I just stand up and blab away. We're going to not do that today. But I got to cover Buford first, so we'll be talking a little bit about the cavalry. On June 30th, at the base of the mountains, for those of you, I don't know where everybody's background is, so therefore I have to get make sure I cover everything, is Cashtown, about 8 miles away. Harry Heath sent in J. Johnston Pettigrew's brigade with the 55th Virginia to see if they could get supplies at Gettysburg with the orders. If you find disorganized troops, you can attack, but if you find organized troops, pull back. They make their way, they get to the seminary at about 9 o'clock, send skirmishers in town, and as they're looking from the seminary to the south of town, they see the Union cavalry under John Buford arrive in town. The way the guy rides a horse is very evident. This is not disorganized troops, and they pull back to Cashtown, and Pettigrew goes to Heath and tells him, "We have found the Union army in town, and we heard drums on the south side of town, which would indicate infantry." Where that drum came from, I have no idea, because there was no infantry here near it at this time. Now we have an argument. Heath will not believe Pettigrew. And as the argument is progressing, A.P. Hill rides up, and Heath tells him again, tell the story to him. So Pettigrew repeats it to A.P. Hill, and A.P. Hill gets it almost right. He says, "The only troops in town are the cavalry." That's correct. "And they're there for observation." That's correct. "But there's no infantry near Gettysburg." That's incorrect, because 8 miles south of town is the Union First Corps under guy on the horse, John Reynolds. So when that is said, Harry Heath then says, "General, if you have no problems, I will take my division into Gettysburg tomorrow." And the three words Hill says will bring on the battle: "None in the world." And so Harry Heath is coming in on July 1st, really not expecting anything in the way to give him any kind of problem, followed by Pegram's artillery battalion. Pegram is the reserve battalion, and it is not Harry Heath's divisional artillery. Talk about the Union. The cavalry, of course, has spotted the Confederates on the ridge on June 30th, and they have detached two squadrons of the 8th Illinois, who shadows the Confederates back to Marsh Creek, and they stop at Marsh Creek as the Confederates blockade the bridge, basically out there about 4 miles. So Buford knows the Confederates have been near town and probably will be coming back tomorrow in force. And he decides to try to hold the town, writing to John Reynolds to get up here and help him out on July 1st. And his job, not like the movie, to hold the hills south of town, but to hold the Confederates out of town so that Reynolds can decide where to deploy and where to fight. Everybody with that distinction. Now, what he picks are a couple of ridges. Buford does not pick the ridge. It is Gamble's brigade, Colonel William Gamble, that picks the ridge we're standing on. This is McPherson Ridge, named for the McPherson Barn to your right. The reason he picks this is because we have a little shallow creek, Willoughby Run, down at the base of the hill, and we got the biggest slope of the four ridges that are here. Her ridge is where the Red Roof is. He will put his reserve for the skirmish line on her ridge, and then about 3 miles west, the picket post will be set for from above the Chambersburg Pike all the way to below the Fairfield Road, which is the next road down. On the morning of July 1st, at about 5 o'clock from Cashtown, Harry Heath starts in. And about 7 o'clock is near the bridge when they see Union troops up on the ridge. And they have a discussion. Is this Longstreet's men or is this the Union? They think it is Longstreet's men for a while until a sergeant came to them and said, as he was left in Winchester, he was trying to catch up, that he had passed Longstreet 2 days ago behind you. So therefore, it's got to be the Union. In the road down at Marsh Creek, 4 miles out, they deploy the Fredericksburg artillery and start to shoot. And now Harry Heath will deploy the 5th Alabama Battalion of Archer's Brigade as skirmishers. Let me make one point very clear. Buford did not stop Harry Heath. The guy that stops Harry Heath is Harry Heath. He deploys only the 5th Alabama Battalion, and it's the 5th Alabama Battalion who is skirmishing with Buford's skirmishers, and they're pushing them back, but they're certainly pushing them back slowly. If he would have deployed the brigades 4 miles down the road, there would have been no holding action for Buford. But they are pushing them back until they get to the western side of Purr Ridge. And now he stops and does something again pretty silly. He deploys the Fredericksburg artillery, 2 guns, in the road and spends 20 minutes shooting at the western side of Purr Ridge. He's wasting time, isn't he? Well, when he's satisfied, they now take Purr Ridge, let's say roughly at 9 o'clock. In his writings, it is 9 o'clock. And from Purr Ridge, what does he see over here on both sides of the road? But Buford's cavalry brigades deployed and one battery in the center of the road. That is Caliph's battery. Caliph has 4 guns in the road and another section, 2 guns, far to the south where we'll be in a little bit. Devon's cavalry brigade is up to the right and Gamble's is to the left, with stretching out over the road back by the railroad cut. So the artillery starts to shoot. Caliph tries to respond, but you're outgunned. But they do shoot much better for the north than for the south. So let me just say that it's always kind of even when you're outgunned with artillery for the north, because they got better ammunition and better trained. Archer goes to the right. Davis goes to the left. And they start down off of Purr Ridge. How long does it take to deploy? 20 minutes? Half an hour? Somewhere between 9:20 and 9:30, I would have them moving off the ridge. As they come up the slope, they start to skirmish with the skirmishers from Buford. And now they will start to move on both sides of the road. And there's one major reason you want to leave the road. What's in the road? And what's it going to be shooting? Canister. So you want to avoid the canister. So to avoid the canister, you're going to move off to the left and to the right. And that's why Archer is captured way down there, and Davis is on the other side of the railroad cut to give this artillery wide berth. Okay? Up in the right. Devon's artillery brigade has no shelter like Gamble does. So with the artillery beginning to find the range and horses making a real big target, Devon pulls back to Seminary Ridge. Gamble is still here on McPherson's Ridge. The fight goes on probably for no more than half an hour, maybe 45 minutes, before the infantry arrives on the field. I don't know how many of you have heard that Buford delayed for 2 hours. Let me see you. Go ahead. Okay? Well, it's not Buford. It is Harry Heath. Buford delays about 45 minutes. My point is, if you push harder, you will have a less of a defense by Buford. So now the infantry comes in. relieves the cavalry. Devin goes to the north and begins to picket all the way to the York Road. And of course, we'll spot roads coming in from Carlisle and Early coming in from York. Gamble, can't say enough about Gamble, will drop to the south and get near the Fairfield Road and will tie up the Confederates all afternoon down by the Fairfield Road. Now, the 1st Brigade that Reynolds and the infantry brings in has got 5 regiments in. It's the 2nd Brigade. And you've got to put them on both sides of the road because the cavalry was being pressured on both sides of the road. So the 84th New York, there's the monument, and the 95th, which is on the other side, go past the barn and move into the trees to the south of the road. We're going to leave them there. The 76th New York and the 56th Pennsylvania, which you can see the monuments right on the ridge, cross behind the ridge and start to move north. The 147th New York will try to move behind them, but are stopped and told to form in reserve behind the barn. And we're going to leave them there. Now, with that as a preface, let me do time out and handle any questions anybody has up to this point. Let me tell you, that was real brief.
So the 147th was actually told they were in reserve, right?
Behind the barn.
Right. I thought they just didn't have an assignment.
No, they were actually halted. But I want you to notice one thing. Look over here. Come on over here, guys. The 76th New York and 56th PA cross on the eastern side of the ridge. And they're behind the barn. Then the 147th will be ahead of the other two regiments. Now, the line of march was Cutler's Brigade, which we just talked about, and then Hall's main artillery. Calef is running short of ammunition. So Reynolds sends for Hall and says to him, place you out here in the front so that you can draw the fire of the artillery since Calef has pulled back and we need artillery. And when the infantry gets in place, then I will pull you back. So Wadsworth, who was the division commander, there he is up there on the slope, you can just see the guy pointing over there, thinks that Hall has been taken away from him. And this is going to cause some problems, because Reynolds will ride into the back of the seminary, be riding into the trees, and get shot. So therefore, Wadsworth doesn't think that he has control of Hall, and Hall's going to be out here all by himself against the Confederate artillery. And that's where the screw-up comes. Wadsworth doesn't exert enough pressure to pull him back on his own. Now, any questions up to this point? Where's my little book? Let's start. It's New York. It's under the command of Major Andrew Glover. And here's what they say in their report. On July 1st at about 10:30 a.m., being the extreme advance of the 1st Corps, we reached the battlefield near the seminary at Gettysburg, and while marching by the flank, who can tell me what marching by the flank is? Marching by the flank is a column of fours. Okay, you're in a line of battle, and when you do right face, you're in a column of fours, and that is your right flank. So that's the way you march down a road, column of fours. So they are marching in a column of fours behind the ridge. Why are they behind the ridge?
Cover for you. From the artillery on the...
From the artillery from Heath, okay? We're opened on by the enemy up here. We had Davis on the other side of the cut, didn't we? They were stationed in large force at a distance of 30 rods where they were laying down in the field concealed in the wheat. So look at the ground here to your left. That's what it would be like, and here are the guys laying in the wheat. We were exposed to their fire for several minutes before we replied. The men were cautioned to hold their fire until the enemy appeared, when the orders were given to commence firing. Grover is mistaken. He thinks he's getting fired at by his own men. They take three volleys before Grover lets them fire back. Who is in front of them is the 2nd Mississippi, which would be up past this ridge. The 76th is the farthest monument up there that you can just see, kind of like that, a point on the top of it. At this juncture, a large force of the enemy deployed on our right flank, subjecting us to a galling crossfire. Major Grover then ordered the right wing to change front to the rear. Here's what changing front to the rear is, okay? About face, right wheel, now you've turned, about face, and you got a 90 degree angle. That's the way you refuse your right. Where this was coming from is look past the trees in the open field. You can see a car going up there now. It would be up in that area where the 55th, which is to the left of the 2nd, overlaps. You can see where the 76th is, overlaps, and they're beginning to turn and come in on the flank. Now let me give you a couple of stories. As the 76th and the 56th got into position, Colonel J. William Hoffman of the 56th spotted the 55th way up there. 55th was heading for Devon's cavalry, who had dropped back to the tree line. And he no more than crests the ridge, and he sees these guys that he immediately orders by the right oblique, ready, aim. And the brigade commander, Lysander Cutler, is trying to talk to him and say, are you in distance? And guy doesn't hear him, and he gives fire, and they knock down two men in the color company. But the 55th is a big number, isn't it? The higher the number of the regiment, the more men you have in the regiment normally. And it's fairly new and therefore fairly large. And when you get hit, where are you going to go? Towards where the fire came from. So that's what's going to pull them around. Colonel Connolly, John Kerr Connolly, grabs the flag of the regiment and starts to move forward. Everybody's turning. And 56 gives him another volley. And Connolly goes down and was still holding the flag. And the major, Alfred Bellow, comes up to him and says, are you hurt, Colonel? And Connolly, who is talked about very badly by William Dorsey Pender, okay, anybody heard me do my Pender talk, okay, says, yes, I think I'm mortally wounded. Absolutely not true. He's wounded, but not anywhere near mortally. But he does say to Bellow, throwing the flag at him, take the flag and keep ahead of those damn Mississippians. Stay proud. So they're turning. At this juncture, we were refusing the right flank. With this, Grover falls mortally wounded as the 76th is getting flanked, and just about the same time, Cutler, seeing the flanking movement, orders the two regiments to fall back to Seminary Ridge. So the right flank of the 1st, 2nd Brigade has been pushed back very quickly, because you don't have enough men out here, do you? You got two regiments against three big regiments. What about the 147? Where are they?
They're going to eventually be somewhere.
Where are they right now?
Behind the barn.
Lieutenant Colonel Francis Miller has waited for about 5 minutes, and no orders came for him to do anything. So he rides off, finds Wadsworth, and is told to go across the road and support the two other regiments. Except that he is here behind the barn. So he crosses in the low ground behind the caissons of Howe's artillery, which would be right there. He crosses the railroad cut, and as he crosses, they hear fire coming from the left. So they front, look right across the railroad cut, which is that shrubbery, and you can see there's a little bit of high ground. They start to move up the high ground, and what do they see on the other side but heads of the 42nd Mississippi. So they lay down and start a crossfire over the crest of the ridge, and the 42nd Mississippi cannot make any headway against them. Where's the 55th? What happened to the 55th?
They were chasing that.
If you have broken and driven these two regiments back, then you are going to continue to wheel and you're going to be coming down towards the railroad cut. The 2nd Mississippi, which was also in front, that's the middle regiment, is also going to be turning. So you got two regiments coming in towards the railroad cut. You got the 42nd and the 147th New York fighting each other, and as everybody gives ground to the left, that allows the 42nd to move north and begin to flank the 147th. Wadsworth had seen the regiment out here and had sent an order to Miller to pull the regiment back. Miller takes the order and turns to give the order to retreat, and is shot in the mouth, and the horse bolts, so the 147th doesn't know it's received an order to retire. With Miller off the field, you now have Major Harney in command. He sees the 42nd beginning to flank him, the 2nd Mississippi coming down, and the 55th climbing over a fence. Look right at the top of the hill, right out there between the two trees. See the trees of the railroad cut, and in the distance you see some more trees, bigger trees. Right along the crest of that ridge was a wooden fence that went back to Seminary Ridge. So he refuses the right flank of the 147th behind that wooden fence and tries to take on the 42nd, but he's really afraid because 2nd is coming behind him and the 55th is even farther behind him. As the 42nd moved to the north, the firing over here on the left ceased. And the company on the left was under the command of a guy by the name of Captain Pierce. And he heard some firing going on in front of him and to the left over the ridge. Take a look, you can't see what's there if you're on this side of the ridge, can you? So he takes his company forward to the crest of the ridge and looks off to the left, and what does he see? Some of the 42nd have looked at Hall's battery, and with infantry, what do you always want to capture? If not a flag, artillery. So they have tried to come in, and it forced Hall to take four guns and turn them and blast away with canister and drove these guys, let's call them skirmishers, back into the railroad cut. But they lay along the bank of the railroad cut and popped away at Hall, and he was taking some hits. The other two guns were firing at the artillery over on her ridge. So that's what Captain Pierce hears. So he takes the company, moves them to the top, faces them by the left flank, and they open up on the left in the rear of the Confederates in the railroad cut, who are surprised as hell, and of course are going to make a beeline out of the cut to get away from the fire. One of the real sad things is, Hall says, I beat off everybody by myself, when in fact he was actually saved by the 147th. Now Hall knows, as he looks back to the right, he sees the 76th and the 56th retreating, and he makes the famous statement, if this position is too far advanced for the infantry, it's sure too far advanced for the artillery. And he takes the right section, two guns, tells them to go back 75 yards, set up, and put down some fire so the rest of the battery can get out. There's only one problem with that. As they're pulling back, they're pulling right into the area where the 55th North Carolina and the 2nd Mississippi is coming down towards the railroad cut. So, I think the guy's name is Umble, limbers up and pulls both of these guns out. The other guns begin to come out, and one gun will have every horse shot dead. And the Confederates will pile over the railroad cut and capture that gun just before you get to the crest over there. I believe it's on this side, isn't it, John? Yeah, okay. 55th, 2nd Mississippi capture the gun. Who's still out here?
147.
They're in big trouble, aren't they? Okay. So now, Wadsworth and Doubleday, Doubleday now in command of the army because Reynolds is dead, is riding back from the Iron Brigade section to look out and see this regiment. And Doubleday turns to Wadsworth and says, I thought you pulled everybody back. And Wadsworth said, I gave orders for everybody to pull back. And he takes Captain Ellsworth, how'd you like to be Ellsworth? And he says, go out there and tell him to retreat. Ellsworth gets on his horse, lays down so that he's not got anything sticking up, okay, and rides kind of diagonally across to Harney and the 147th New York. At the same time, Harney was having a meeting with his officers trying to decide what to do, and they pretty well had concluded the time came to leave. And at that time, up comes Ellsworth, tells him to retreat, and Harney gives the order, about face, march and retreat at the double quick, and away they go. Now, they come two ways. Some guys make the wrong choice. Where do you think seems safest from over there? The railroad cut. Unfortunately, as they go down the railroad cut, they're going to run right into the Confederates from the 2nd and the 55th. The guys who get away will come across the railroad cut to the road and get out that way. So the right flank of Cutler has been broken. Any questions on that?
Is the entire 147th Regiment on the other side of the railroad cut?
Everybody is on the other side of the railroad cut.
About how many guys was there?
Probably, I can look that up in a moment. I would say offhand about 450. We lose about 50% casualties. Okay? Let me finish off with Hall. One gun is here. Hall goes back, pretty shot up, is ordered to go all the way back to Cemetery Hill. Goes all the way back to Cemetery Hill and is told, go back out where you came. He meets in town a staff officer who says, I will direct you. And he puts him in the railroad cut down in town, and out they come. And as they come out, got a clear shot from Pearl Ridge. And he talks about not being able to turn to the left or to the right until he gets to the seminary. But thankful, he is not hurt very badly. When he gets up here, the Confederates will have been driven back, and he asks Wadsworth to be able to pull the gun off, and he is sent out with the caisson. They pick up the gun and take it back, and then Hall is sent to the cemetery where his monument is in the cemetery today. Okay, look over to the right of the road, to behind you. Colonel Edward Fowler of the 84th New York, which is also called the 14th Brooklyn. On entering the field, the 95th New York Volunteers and the 14th State Militia were formed on the left of the brigade, a house and a garden intervening between them and the right wing. That would be the barn, and the house would be a little bit farther to the south. We were at once engaged by the enemy skirmishers from our woods to our left and front, down there, by Willoughby Run. We drove the enemy back, and I found the enemy were advancing on our right. Who's over here?
2nd, 55th, and 42nd.
Okay. We then, and we're then to our rear and in possession of one of our artillery pieces, Hall's Battery. Immediately, I ordered my command, the 95th New York and the 14th New York State Militia, to march in retreat. What's that mean? You got a line of battle. You got the fire posers in the rear, right? The sergeants and the lieutenants. Marching in retreat is about face, and you move off the field with your fire posers leading. Unlike the fight in the wheat field where you tried to get the fire posers behind the front line. Okay? Marching in retreat, that means they're marching parallel with the Confederates. Until we were on a line with the enemy and then change front perpendicular, which would be facing north, to face them. The enemy also changing front to face us. So you got a line along the railroad cut, you got a line back here left of the barn. At this time, the 6th Wisconsin gallantly advanced to our assistance. So they're coming up, and we'll be talking about them in a little bit. The enemy took possession of a railroad cut. I gave the order to charge, which was gallantly carried out by all the regiments, by which the piece of artillery was recaptured. So they're coming from the road to the cut. The advance was continued until near the cut, when I directed the 6th Wisconsin to flank it by throwing their right across the railroad and enfilade the railroad cut. The enemy within our reach surrendered officers, battle flags, and men. Those in line on the left of their line escaped through the following railroad cut. So they're coming out the west. What was the important piece about that besides the charge? He is indicating that he is giving commands to the 6th Wisconsin. What do you think the 6th Wisconsin is going to say? 6th Wisconsin is going to say, we did it on our own, okay? Now, 95th New York is under the command of Colonel George Biddle. There are three Biddles here on the field. Chapman Biddle will be at command of a brigade, and Alexander will be command of the 121st because Chapman has moved up. The third one is 95th New York George Biddle. As they came up to the road, okay, Colonel Biddle was wounded and the command devolved upon Major Edward Pye, PYE. As he was over there, Lieutenant Colonel Rufus Stiles of the 6th Wisconsin came to Pye and told Pye, we need to make a charge. And Pye will say, charge it is. Give the order and we'll go. Sixth Wisconsin. In the morning of July 1st, as the brigade moved forward in support of the 2nd Brigade of this division, 2nd Brigade is Cutler, okay, to engage the enemy, I received an order to move my command forward rapidly and form it on the left of the line of the brigade. Without checking from a double quick, the regiment formed into line, the men loading as they marched and moved forward rapidly, steadily towards the position assigned. They're coming in on the Fairfield Road or the Hagerstown Pike. Before reaching my position in the line of battle, I was ordered to halt and hold the men in reserve. At this juncture, the brigade guard, two officers and 100 men, under command of First Lieutenant Lloyd Harris of the 6th Wisconsin, joined me. I divided the guard into two companies placing one on each side of the regiment. I now received a second order to advance, which I was proceeding to execute when by command of Major Doubleday, Major General Doubleday commanding the corps, the regiment again halted, and here's the important piece, my left resting on the Fairfield Road. So where are they? All the way down there. They're going to act as a general reserve. In a few minutes, I received an order from Doubleday to move at once to the support of the right, 76th and the 56th and the 147th, which was being forced back and outflanked by the enemy. I marched by the right flank at the double quick, which is marching by the right flank. Come on, guys, you got to get this. Column of fours, okay? Until we neared the road, at which point I filed off to the right, fronted, and moved to the road, and started to fire at the enemy. He begins to take casualties, and he has the men climb the fences, and as he's over on this side of the fence, he sees the 84th and the 95th arrive on his left flank. That's Fowler coming up. And he says, we got to make a charge. This is when he comes over to talk to the 95th commander, but Biddle is wounded, so it's got to be Pye. And he says, we must charge. And Pye says, charge it is. The whole line moved forward upon a double quick, well closed up in the face of a destructive fire from the enemy. When our line reached the edge of the cut, the rebels began throwing down their arms in the token of surrender. Adjutant Edward Brooks, with promptness and foresight, moved a detachment of 20 men in position to enfilade the cut from the right. When the entire regiment in my front, after some murderous skirmishing by the more desperate, threw down their arms in token of surrender. Major John Blair, commanding the 2nd Mississippi, upon my demand, surrendered his sword to me. I directed him to have his men fall in without arms and move to the rear in charge of Major John Hauser of this regiment. Corporal F. Ashbury Walker of Company I won the Medal of Honor for capturing the flag of the 2nd Mississippi. Sergeant William Evans was wounded, and you still got to stay out here and fight. So they gave Evans the flag, and he started back in town and would be captured. But some ladies of the town would help wind the flag around his body, and he would be, because he's wounded, you don't carry him back through Richmond. And so the flag would be brought off the battlefield because of the ladies winding it around his body. You didn't hear anything in there about Fowler telling him to send a flanking force on the railroad cut. Whether Fowler did, and I tend to believe these things happen, I don't tend to believe anybody purposefully lies, but I think he probably sent the orders, and Brooks had already taken it under his command to move the guys to the railroad cut. And if you see a flanking force and you send somebody over there to tell them, what are you going to think? I took command of the force. So the guys that get captured by the charge are going to get captured right underneath the bridge, because if you look, that is by far the deepest part. Look over here, you got low ground that you can get up over the back and you can get out. The 55th, which is farthest over, has got almost level ground. And they will back out, and they will be the guard who tries to delay whatever is happening as they move back across the field. The main point, Davis's brigade has been severely handled here on day one. And they will form behind you across a wheat field in the trees to your rear. And we'll talk about them later when we're back out here talking about the end of the fight with Stone. So let me handle any questions you have about this. area in the fight up here on day one.
What do you think Davis was while all this was going?
Davis is probably back here.
Okay. The barn, apparently, or?
Probably up with the brigade.
Yeah.
Okay.
Didn't have pretty good control of it.
No. He did not have pretty good control of it, and that's one of the problems. The first part of the fight is certainly kind of guys doing their own thing at the same time. Okay.
What do you think of Wadsworth?
I think Wadsworth is a very fine general.
I pray for this.
Ten to probably 11. And brigade probably 10:15, 10:30 to 11:15, 11:30. I would give each one an hour, probably offset by 15 minutes. Remember, the 1st Brigade is broken between the 1st Brigade is behind the artillery, so you got to get the artillery in place before they can come on the field over there.
That dispatcher, Buford, said, you sent help behind the Rhine 30. I think that's long. I think he's early with that, and you think that time that he writes is long.
No, I think that could work. I mean,
10 o'clock. I mean, those guys weren't in sight yet. They're in the woods by 10. He's already sent help at 9:30.
Yeah, let me just say, you can take a half an hour and push it up. Okay. Half an hour. The time varies here. You know. So, yeah.
So do they know on the other side of the bridge that the 14th Brooklyn's on this side?
No.
When they're making an attack.
No. Now. This is going to be setting up for next week. After you win out here, Cutler takes the whole brigade and corrects them on the other side of the hill and then moves forward to the original position. So the original position is right there where you see the cars. And what's going to drive them out? The Rhodes Division, when they come in and put artillery on the hill, they will infill the line, causing them to retire. And when we hear Stone later, he will talk, when they come in, about seeing the troops on his right pulling back, and that's what causes him to turn facing to the north, because there's nobody on the right flank anymore. But you can't just stand there and get whacked by the artillery coming in from Rhodes.
The terrain up here, do you think it was built up because of putting the bridge in here?
Yes. The actual level of the cut is down where you see the monument.
Actually,
I'm telling you, even if you go up there now, you will see that you still got about a 15-foot drop, okay?
The base of the monument?
The base of the monument, correct. That hump that you can see coming up.
The grassy area, yeah.
The grassy area, right. That was there for the monument.
It's right up there.
For the bridge, not the monument.
Right up there where they covered the bridge.
2,305 less the 11th Mississippi, which was 592. Anybody got a fast mathematical mind? Okay, of which they lose 920. But that, of course, includes day three, Pickett's Charge. Who else you want to know here?
Didn't someone have a question about
147?
147, yeah.
The left regiment. The next regiment is the 24th Michigan, the 19th Indiana, the 7th Wisconsin, and the last one is the 2nd Wisconsin. I'm morning, July 1st, the regiment had the right and approached Gettysburg from the Emmitsburg Pike. About 10 a.m., then near the town of Gettysburg, the brigade was filed into the field to the left and west of Gettysburg from the Emmitsburg Pike in the direction of Seminary Ridge. That's near the Cadoy Farm. Here the Federal cavalry was in line with the battery actively engaged with the enemy's advancing infantry. By order of the division commander, this regiment was thrown forward into the line of battle in front of the cavalry and ordered to advance to repel an assault of the enemy's infantry. The field officers, Colonel Fairchild, Lieutenant Colonel Stevens, and Major John Mansfield, immediately dismounted and taking their proper places in line, advanced. The regiment moved up a gentle slope. When on the crest, we received a volley of musketry from the enemy's line, from which many officers and men fell, among them Lieutenant Colonel Stevens, mortally wounded. The advance of the regiment was steadily kept up under the direction of Colonel Fairchild, slightly obliquing to the right into a piece of timbers, skirting the ridge and extending several hundred yards to the right and in front of our position. Where are we? Where's the gentle slope? Right out there. Obliquing to the right into the trees. So he's coming in right about over where the car is. After pushing the advance for about 50 yards into the timber, in the face of a most terrific fire, Colonel Fairchild received a severe wound in his left arm, shattering his elbow, being so completely disabled and suffering from loss of blood, he was taken to the rear, and Major Mansfield assumed command of the regiment. Mansfield continued to advance the regiment to near close quarters, when the line of the enemy in our immediate front yielded, a portion seeking cover in a deep excavation of ground from which they attempted to reform their broken lines. I ordered a charge upon this last position of the enemy, which was gallantly made at the double quick, the enemy breaking in confusion to the rear, escaping from the timber into the open fields beyond. We will be there in a little bit. That is called the quarry. John, where are you? There you are. John has found a second quarry that's out in the open field. The one I'm going to take you to is in the woods. If you get John's quarry, you would be out of the trees into the open field. The quarry we're going to go to is in the trees, and it's much deeper, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it would be a place you would want to reform. But I believe you said it was after the war?
Right. In fact, it was a trash dump for the spring of the hotel.
Okay.
The larger one.
So, I can't believe the quarry and the excavation he's talking about can be the one in the open field. So, if it's not this one, it had to be something that looked awfully much like this one down there. In the charge, we captured a large number of prisoners, including several officers, among them General Archer, who was taken prisoner by Patrick Maloney of Company G, and brought to me, to whom he surrendered his sword, which I passed over the prisoners to Lieutenant Daly, who took Archer's sword. I regret to say that the gallant soldier, Private Maloney, was killed in action later in the day. After the disposition of the prisoners, the regiment was formed in the open field beyond the timber. What is he talking about? Not this field. He's over there. On the other side of Willoughby Run, after you get by the stuff that has grown up near the banks, it is open, all the way to the top of Her Ridge, where if you go today, you're going to get hit by a golf ball, because that's the country club, okay? But it was open. We were soon faced to the rear and retired about midway through the timber, where we were ordered to lie down and remain in position for some 2 hours. When the enemy were discovered emerging from the timber beyond the field we had just left, and that's the afternoon fight as Pettigrew came in. Where is the 2nd Wisconsin? They come in from right about where the road is, on an oblique, trying to build their line as they come through and hit the Confederates and drive them back to the excavation, capturing them with a charge. And now, because you got a lot of prisoners, what's going to happen to the 2nd Wisconsin? They're going to slow down, and that's going to allow, and you're going to hear this next, the 7th Wisconsin, the 19th Indiana, and the 24th Michigan are going to pass by them because they got their hands full in trying to round up these prisoners, and they'll then join, after they get rid of the prisoners, the guys on the other side of the road. But the 7th Wisconsin would be the first one across the creek and up on the other side. 7th Wisconsin, Colonel William Robinson. Just at the time we came up, a brigade of the enemies was advancing upon the position. We were ordered to take position on the ridge in front of the cavalry as quickly as possible. I immediately formed companies and threw the battalion forward into line at the double quick and advanced to the top of the ridge. Where's the ridge? Point out there. Anybody agree? This is the ridge.
Yeah.
Okay? We had not halted the load, and no orders had been received to do so for the reason, I suppose, but no one expected that we were to be engaged so suddenly. I, however, gave the order to load during the movement, which was executed by the men while on the double quick, so that no time would be lost by this omission. I halted the battalion on the summit of the ridge until the 19th and the 24th Michigan, which were in my rear in column, had formed on my left. So the 2nd has passed on by, the 7th has come up, but it's waiting, and it takes some time for the other two regiments to form. So it's not everybody moving in like most people assume in one big line. The 2nd is going to take the brunt of this fight because they're out there by themselves. In the meantime, the 2nd Wisconsin, which was next to me in front, in column, the length of a battalion in advance, and this threw them behind the grove mentioned into which they advanced without halting, had engaged the enemy. My right now rested on the grove. Right down there is the 7th, with the 19th and the 24th to my left. I will guarantee you that most people think that the Iron Brigade itself fought in this woods. And I'm telling you that if you look down there, well, I guess we can't see it.
Fine.
There's a barn down there, you can maybe just see the top of it, but that's where the 24th Michigan would be, because they're right next to the 6th Wisconsin, who's got its left on the road. So they're going to really be very stretched out here on the ridge. Immediately in front and running parallel at about 200 yards was a ravine. You can just see the part of it over here to the right. When we come back from down there, which is where we're going next, we'll walk out there and take a look at the ravine and then go down to the excavation. It was at first uncertain in the dense smoke and from the near proximity of the fire whether it was the enemy or the left wing of the 2nd Wisconsin. At this moment, Captain Wadsworth of the division staff, does that name ring a bell? Awful nice to have your, I don't know what the relationship is, but some relative being the divisional commander, you can certainly get promoted to captain, okay? Rode up from the right, and I asked him whether he could tell whether the troops firing from the ravine were the enemy. He pointed a little farther to the left, up the ravine. So the Confederates are way down there too, where I saw the rebel battle flag and said he said it was the enemy, and that the general directed me that we should drive them out. I moved the line forward to the crest of the ridge, delivered a volley, and gave the order to charge. The three regiments, the 7th Wisconsin, 19th Indiana, and 24th Michigan, rushed into the ravine with a yell. The enemy threw down their arms and ducked between us to the rear as prisoners. We moved up the opposite bank to the top of a hill. They can't move up to Hull Ridge, can they? Because you got Rockenbrough and Pettigrew up there, so evidently what they have is, as you go up, there's like little hills and dales, and they go up to the first high ground, which would be probably leveled now by the play, by the golf course. We occupied our position but a few minutes when Captain Richardson of the brigade staff brought an order to change front to the rear. With this evolution being executed, General Meredith came up and directed me to place my regiment in the grove on the right of the 2nd Wisconsin. So the grove is right here. He's not in the open field. I took the position indicated, my right resting on the open field, and threw out skirmishers into the front. And in this position, we lay some hours under a severe artillery fire, and he could see the movements of the enemy up on the ridge. Any questions about where he is? Why is the 2nd Wisconsin moved into the center?
They want to have a stronger regiment on the flank.
Exactly right. Who took the most casualties? Mm-hmm. So you want to protect them a little bit by moving one who was not as severely hit over on the right and try to shield the 2nd. 19th Indiana, Colonel Samuel Williams. Shortly after starting, this is down at Emmitsburg, the sound of distant cannonade announced that the skirmishers of the two armies had met. The column pressed on and soon, more rapidly than before, reached a point within 2 miles of Gettysburg and filed to the left. Where are they filing to the left from? Cadore Farm, okay? When Reynolds had come out here and talked to Buford, he rode back to the Cadore Farm, had his staff take down the fences on the western side of the road. We passed over cleared fields for 3/4 of a mile. The column entered a wood skirting the seminary, bearing to the right. After emerging from this strip of woods, the line passed nearly parallel with it until my regiment was directly in the rear of the seminary building. Any of you have taken a thing from Tim Smith, Tim will have them coming in diagonally from the road, and here's Colonel Williams telling you that he is moving from the seminary building, which is right over there. There's only one problem. What's the rear? Is it on the east or is it on the west? I have no idea. My guess is going to be that the front is facing town, and what you see today in the steps is probably the rear. So I think he's coming up in the west, even though to me that doesn't make any sense because you would be seen by the artillery. But I do believe he doesn't talk about passing by the seminary. Mm-hmm. He talks about moving right now across the open field. But he is coming from right about there. One of the problems may be that the two regiments have moved separately. Because the 2nd Wisconsin is coming in from the road here, right? And the 7th is down there. And look where the seminary is. Only, how about, let me give you another, what if we talk about the Schmucker house? That's the seminary, isn't it? Superintendent's house, that would be on the Fairfield Road. That's what makes this stuff so interesting, because you can't really get clear-cut what happens. Okay. The cavalry skirmishers were in our front, and they were withdrawn, and the infantry ordered forward. Facing my regiment to the left, if you're in a column of fours, facing to the left to get in the line of battle, without checking the march for an instant, I ordered it forward at the double quick to gain the summit of a little rise behind which the enemy were in part sheltered. This was but the work of a few moments. Where's the ridge? They keep talking about this ridge. This is the ridge, not out there.
Is this McPherson's ridge or not? Or is this kind of a spur? I see that's the level of cut up there, right?
Let me tell you one thing. When we walk down there, you will see that where the 26th North Carolina Monument is ends right over there. The ridge that continues is right here. You can see it falling off right down there. So, unless they built that up for the road, which may be, but it doesn't look like it, then that ends, McPherson Ridge ends out there, and this, what we call the Ripple or
East Burn,
okay, is the one that actually continues down, okay?
Scott calls it, Hartwick calls it, there's an east and a west McPherson
Ridge.
Yes,
I call it, well, that's my normal terminology, west-east, okay, mm-hmm. But the east is a lot farther
mm-hmm.
to the south,
right.
Okay? So the ridge he's talking, it's not real far over on this side, but it is real far on this side. So the ridge they're talking about is East McPherson here to the south, not to the north, but to the south. At the foot of the rise along Willoughby Run, and not more than 75 yards distance, lay James J. Archer's Rebel Brigade, partly hidden from the view by the low shrubbery which lined its banks. The boys, it is but just to say, did not stand upon the order to fire, but fired at once without, for a moment, slackening their pace, and pressing steadily forward, crossed the run, capturing the enemy in the front, and ascending the opposite bank where the line was halted. Closing the column, in, you want to close everybody up, in pursuance to orders, I marched the regiment back across the creek and again formed it in line of battle with the other regiments of the brigade, the line now being on the same ground so lately occupied by the enemy. So they don't come all the way back up here, they are where you see the monuments today. I now threw forward skirmishers and remained in this position until about 3 o'clock. Lieutenant Colonel Dudley will have his leg amputated here, and he does a lot of reporting also. And I believe this is where Tim gets the idea that they moved directly from the Fairfield Road to Hagerstown Pike out here on an angle, because he talks about coming to the Hagerstown Pike and then moving directly to the west. So that would be on an oblique angle to get into the fight. So I think that's where Timmy probably has picked this up. The 24th Michigan talk about the Confederates. They talk about a severe fight. This is not a quote, this is kind of paraphrasing. What I never had heard before, and this is coming from the 1st Tennessee in the Confederate veteran, a guy by the name of Captain Turney, he says that Heath ordered Archer forward to ascertain the strength of the enemy battle line. But Archer protested, saying his brigade was too small. I had never heard that before until I referenced this. Anybody else has ever heard that? Okay. For 30 minutes, the firing was severe and the smoke hovered near the ground, shutting out the view of the movements of the Federal forces. When the enemy's fire ceased, I dropped to my knees and on looking beneath the hanging smoke, saw the feet and the legs of the enemy moving towards our left. Now, you got to be back there looking up this way, okay? Now, for 30 minutes, the firing was severe. Who would that be? Who were they fighting? This confused me until I sat down and thought about it, okay? First, let me place 7th Tennessee, 14th Tennessee, and now we got a big argument. I love these arguments. 1st Tennessee, 13th Alabama. You see, most maps will have 1st Tennessee on the flank, 13th Alabama in the middle. So this guy is in the 1st Tennessee. Who would be the fire that they're fighting for 30 minutes? 7th? Everybody thought.
Cavalry down here?
The cavalry, and who else is here at the beginning? 84th and the 95th New York. You got, they're the first ones in. They got in here as the other regiments were firing across the field. So however long it takes you to get across the field, the 84th and the 95th had already started the fight, okay? Plus the cavalry. And then, if you remember, Hall has to come up and be placed before the Iron Brigade actually gets on the field. So this may take in the neighborhood of 20 minutes before the Iron Brigade arrives on the field. If you're down here looking down through the smoke, looking to your left, and you see guys moving to your left flank, that is probably the 2nd Wisconsin. Isn't that the way they're moving when they hit the road here? Moving to the left. So that's where you kind of can coordinate the attack. Left Cache Town, this is 7th Tennessee, early in the morning, advanced 3 miles. When we came on the enemy's pickets, they gradually fell back before the Confederates for about 3 miles. This brought the brigade in view of the enemy, who were drawn up on a slight hill in front of them and to the right of the road. Here, Archer halted the brigade for a short time for a battery to be brought up and shelled the enemy. As the artillery fire, Archer deployed the brigade into line and advanced against the enemy through an open field. That's the open field on the other side of Willoughby Run. Across the field was a small creek lined by a wooden fence and undergrowth. These obstacles impeded the brigade's advance, but the brigade rushed on and met the enemy beyond. At 40 or 50 yards from the enemy, the brigade opened on the enemy. Shortly after, the enemy appeared upon the brigade's right flank. Hot in the crossfire, the brigade's position became untenable, and the right of the brigade line was forced back. The enemy also made a demonstration upon the brigade's left. The whole line began falling back, but the obstructions hindered the retreat, and about 75 men of the brigade, including General Archer, were captured. With no immediate support at hand, the brigade fell back across the creek in the field and reformed behind Pettigrew's brigade that had been advancing as support. And Colonel Fry now takes command of the brigade. 7th Tennessee again. Southern Bivouac. This is the book that Bradford published. About a mile and a half from town, we discovered the Federal pickets. The 5th Alabama deployed as skirmishers with the rest of Archer's brigade in line of battle to the right of the road behind the skirmishers. Davis's brigade formed to the left of the road. The 5th Alabama pressed the Union pickets backward for about half a mile when the enemy appeared in force. At this point, they halted and the artillery came up, and shortly before 12 o'clock, we reinforced the skirmish line. The artillery opened and the Battle of Gettysburg had begun. The left was driving the enemy successfully, but in a few moments we could plainly see that a division of Reynolds' corps was about to completely envelop our right, and our line was forced to retire with considerable loss, including General Archer. The enemy swung around the right in force and his flank movement was concealed by a strip of woods near our extreme right. Our right center was in an open field. We're in the field. Okay? And our left, near the road, in the woods. So there's the left. Our brigade fell back hastily to a ravine upon the ground, rising in front and rear. Then we reformed when Pettigrew and Bracken Brown's brigade came up and formed behind us. Now, look out there. There's a weak here. Here comes the controversy. 1st Tennessee or 13th Alabama on the right flank? How many heard? The 1st Tennessee. Okay?
That was the 5th covering down by the Herbst. Is that?
5th is back behind Willoughby Run, having done its skirmish duties. It's just kind of back there, probably, if any place it would be, but it was really not into the fight at all, having done the 4-mile push. Okay, 13th Alabama, guy by the name of Dr. William Moon. This is in the Confederate veteran. We were now in easy range of the Federals across the run, who were firing but not advancing. We continued to advance, but in a walk, loading and firing as we went, until we reached a strip of lowland along the run. There we were protected from the fire of the enemy by an abrupt rise across the run in our front. We halted to reform, reload, catch our breath, and cool off a little. It was about 9 a.m. and it was hot, hotter, and hottest. I think 9 a.m. is certainly too early. While we were thus engaged, the Tennesseans on our left advanced through a copse which ran up a ravine, spreading out into a fan shape as it neared the top of the ridge behind it. They were hotly engaged, the Yanks charging them in column, the Tennesseans lying on their backs to load and whirling over to fire. At this stage, Colonel George of a Tennessee regiment, the only man to go into the fight on horseback, rode down the line and requested General Archer or Colonel Aiken, they were close together, to left wheel the 13th Alabama so as to cross fire on the Federals in front of the Tennesseans. This move placed the right of our regiment on or near the crest of a ridge about 75 yards from the Bluecoats, into which we were pouring volley after volley as fast as we could load and shoot. We were rather enjoying the fray when, in order to fall back to Willoughby Run, and we could see no reason for that order, as the Tennesseans were keeping the boys in blue busy and things were going pretty well for us. And here's the important piece. As we only had a line of skirmishers on our right, to which we gave little attention. If you had a line of skirmishers, which evidently has to be Buford's cavalry, right? If they are on in the center and the 1st Tennessee is on the right, they wouldn't have even seen the skirmishers, because the 1st Tennessee would be dealing with the skirmishers number two. Would you wheel to the left? Because here's where the 13th Alabama is facing north after they wheeled, if the 1st Tennessee was on your right and create a gap between two regiments. I think not. In Gettysburg Magazine, I think it is volume 6, man or woman, Scotch and Scotch, write an article, and they claim the 13th is on the right because, logically enough, the regiment who gets hit on the flank, where does the break come? On the right, doesn't it? So the one who is on the right would suffer the most casualties and as it moved up to the center, the guys in the center would have more indication the right is giving way and would be able to get away without as many casualties. And if you compare the 1st Tennessee and the 13th has got about 100 more casualties. Whoa! Let me go to my little book here. Okay? 13th. Strength, 308, 70% casualties. Tennessee? 281, 63% casualties. So by that, I buy in 7% more casualties is probably a good indication that the 13th was on the right flank. But I'm telling you, at least half or three-fourths of the books will indicate the 1st Tennessee is on the right. So if you get the Gettysburg Magazine, go read it yourself, make your own decision. It can be either one of these two regiments. There is a quote, and I just lost it, by one of these Confederates that says the 13th was the right regiment. Okay? Any questions on it? Because now we'll be back here for Pettigrew. Went to John Ratchard and offered to pay for the dead wood, and he'll cut it up himself and sign a waiver in case he cuts his hand off. And Ratchard said no. You get a field that would look much better. I'm not talking about dropping trees, I'm talking about the ones that are on the ground. You'd get the dead trees off the ground, you'd get a much better looking battlefield, and he would get free or cheaper wood. And the park said no. So
maybe Lasher thinks those trees are deer.
I won't comment on the deer. The Gettysburg. The left wing. That meant Doubleday immediately had the first car. If Doubleday has the first car, Thomas Riley, Brigadier from Pittsburgh, my hometown, drunk just like I used to be, right? Okay, is leading in the brigade, and Chapman Biddle is leading in Riley's brigade. The other brigade in Doubleday's division, which would be Riley's division, is Roy Stone's Pennsylvanians. And they'll fight up near the barn, and we'll hit that. That's where we're going to end up. Let me talk about Biddle's brigade, and let me read something to you by Colonel Theodore Gates, who had just joined the brigade on the 30th of June. My regiment joined the brigade on the afternoon of the 30th, and on the morning at 8 a.m., I marched with the brigade and reached a position near the enemy about 1.5 miles west of Gettysburg, where the brigade was immediately formed in line of battle, faced due north, my battalion holding the left. Where was that? Where was that? Those of you who know, don't say, okay? Here? The brigade was soon moved by the right flank 0.5 mile to the southwest, and a new line of battle formed facing west.
At one point they were right out in the woods, weren't they?
Let me read you another part of his report. He writes two reports. Both of these are from the ORs. Marched with the brigade at 8 a.m. on July 1st, and between 10 and 11 a.m. that morning, encountered the enemy skirmishers 1.5 miles west of Gettysburg. Line of battle of the brigade was immediately formed on the Hagerstown Road, my regiment on the left, and the brigade advanced 200 to 300 yards, where it was faced by the right flank and moved through the fields towards Gettysburg, crossing Willoughby's Run between the road and a house and outbuildings around where our dismounted cavalry were skirmishing. Where is that?
Oh, sorry, we'll be wrong.
They come up in the direction that Birney's division.
Yeah, forget what I just said.
They come up the route that Humphrey's division of the Third Corps does on the night of the 1st and arrive up on her ridge facing the artillery and move 200 yards into the Confederate position where they say, where am I? Let me get the hell out of here. Move by the right flank down off her ridge, cross Willoughby Run, and form here where we are now. Here's your teaser. What happens if he attacks? He is on the right flank of the Confederate artillery on her ridge. You only got a brigade, and it's a small brigade, but still enough, you could have created havoc over there. But there's one of the real interesting pieces of the battle, that the brigade was up on her ridge, and of course it would have been shattered if it did attack, but still enough, it would have bought a lot of time, because Pettigrew would have had to be moving down to take care of them. Okay, so that's where it is. Now, first position is on her ridge. Second position is right here. Reaching the low ground between the seminary and the first ridge west of it, the brigade filed to the left and took a position on the easterly slope of the ridge, nearly opposite the seminary, facing west. So where's the seminary? Okay, so right in here is where the brigade is. Remaining here a few moments only, we moved forward on the ridge and down into the ravine where Willoughby Run flows. Right of the brigade passing near the grove where Reynolds fell. So they're up there pretty far, okay? Here we received the enemy's fire, but did not reply to it, and were shortly moved back onto the ridge. All the regiments of the brigade passing over the ridge and taking cover, save my regiment, which was ordered to halt on the crest and face towards the enemy. But even so, only an occasional shot reached our position. So how many positions you got now? One, two, three, four. Gets better. Having remained here some 20 minutes, I was now ordered to throw out a company of skirmishers to occupy the house and building spoken of. That's the Harmon House. I detached Captain Baldwin and Company K for this duty. And Baldwin is out there for about, an hour or so when he requests support, and Gates sends out Captain Cunningham and Company G. So there'll be two companies out there at the Harmon House skirmishing with the Confederates. Now, just make one point here. You got two companies in the house, and that's going to be near the right of the brigade. That is going to give them some problems, and they'll have to turn some men from the attack to deal with the house. Let me get rid of them. The two companies held these buildings until the enemy actually surrounded them on three sides and had fired the outbuildings and attempted to fire the house, when to avoid being captured, the men were withdrawn and moving southerly through a ravine, covered in a measure by a small party of our cavalry. Whose cavalry?
Gamble.
They escaped and rejoined the regiment on the evening at Cemetery Hill. About 2 p.m., the enemy opened an infrared fire on us with 3 Radman guns. Absolutely incorrect. There are no Radmans on the field. Radmans are a siege cannon. Planted upon an elevation a mile or two to our right. Look up. What do you see? Oak Hill. Okay? Upon what seemed to be the shoulder of the ridge upon which we were lying, the brigade was then ordered up and moved by the left flank partly across the Hagerstown Road when it was halted, and after some 10 minutes during which the enemy obtained a very accurate range, the brigade was posted in the road and faced to the north and partially covered by the bank of the roadside. That fifth position? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Lines and Colonel Theodore Gates of the 20th State Militia of New York, commanding the 2nd. In this formation, the brigade moved across the field at the foot of and parallel with the ridge until we reached a point opposite the seminary. When they changed direction to the left, and while the first line moved towards and nearly opposite the woods where Reynolds fell, the second moved to the top of the ridge to support a battery. Now, let me get rid of some of the artillery down here. First of all, right there, you see some artillery. That is the left section of Caleb, Sergeant Federal. And one of the things that they were doing was shooting at the Tennesseans when they were coming over from the hill. So the Tennesseans always talk, 1st Tennessee, about getting hit by artillery, and the artillery for the south could not respond to it until the guys got down at the bottom of the hill. So the 1st Tennessee has to be kind of like right out there in front of the artillery. Total for the back. Out of ammunition, resupplies, Hall takes their place, then Hall is pulled back. That means you have no artillery out here, doesn't it? So Wadsworth scrapes up Caliph again, who is now resupplied, and sends him back up to where Hall's battery was. Remember where that was by the Reynolds statue. Part of the Iron Brigade, 6th Wisconsin, and one of the Kepler's regiments, I think it's the 84th New York, have sent back right where we were standing, doing the right side of the road, in support of Caleb. Caleb is pulled back with Buford when he goes down here to the left into the trees. The next battery that comes up and takes a position right where Caleb and Hall was, is Reynolds artillery. Reynolds artillery is right up there past Doubleday when we were standing doing the Iron Brigade. It was like right behind us. But, of course, that's really an exposed position, and especially when the guns come in from Carlisle, which will be Carter's battery and Fry's Richmond Orange artillery up on the hill. So it moves to the south and gets behind the trees and faces to the north to try to deal with Carter and Fry. The trees will protect its left from the west. Look right up past the artillery. Right in front of it to the left, you see a kind of a square-looking monument. Then beyond, you see a smaller square-looking monument. That marks Cooper's Battery B. Cooper's Battery B came in with the brigade right here. It was placed out there. but it turns and pulls back into the open field to try to get an accurate shot at Carter and Fry. And let me tell you, when you hear this next week, Carter is absolutely beat up there. I can only tell you this a number of times, I can tell it to you again, this is, has impacts all over the battlefield, if it's charged, for instance. There's nobody to compare with the Union artillery. If Stuart is the gem for the South, up until just about this time, right? What did the Union have the advantage in? Their artillery. Better guns, better ammunition, and certainly better training. A lot of Confederates are brave and stand out there and shoot, but there's no way that they can match the mechanical precision of the Union artillery. And therefore, Caliph and Hall is not that much out there, even though there were a lot more guns over there. They were able to sustain themselves pretty fairly when you consider being so far outgunned. And that same argument will hold on Pickett's charge that these gunners cannot knock out the Union artillery. Okay? Now, what will happen is Lee will arrive on the field. He will wait, denying orders to attack the Harry Heath, AP Hill, other generals who are asking him to lead the attack. Let's attack. We can beat them. What is the key piece that makes an attack? Early is coming in. Rhodes is already in up on the hill. Everybody's close. And as I do a tour, I always say, the problem is, look over here behind me. You don't know what's in town because Stuart's not here with the cavalry. But still and all, he has his guys here, and he's willing to take the chance that we can beat these guys. You've never lost a battle. You've got everybody on the field. You're going to have a coordinated attack from two sides from what he can see. With Early coming up here later, looks pretty good for him. So he orders Heath, Hill/Heath, to advance. Pettigrew's brigade is a tremendously large brigade. Pettigrew has 25, almost 2,600 men in the brigade. That's the size of almost two brigades for the North. Brackenbrough has about 1,000. So you've got about 3,500 men that are now going to be sent in from the west against troops who have already taken casualties in the early part of the fight. At the same time, Rhodes will be moving down towards the railroad cut and over towards the trees. And that's what we'll be doing next week. All day, the Iron Brigade had made note of watching them form over there on the ridge. And here is Biddle's brigade, who has just moved north, because what makes them move? Pettigrew starts coming off the hill. Everybody down here will say the same thing. The right of the enemy overlaps our left by a quarter mile. If you overlap somebody's left by a quarter mile, the defender's in big time trouble. So, the right regiment will be down near the road. The brigade is probably right where the monument is now, down there. So, it's overlapping. Gates again. The enemy was now advancing towards our position in the line of battle, and the infantry fire became very severe. The battery was compelled to fire after shooting a few rounds. Now, Cooper has moved back. Reynolds has moved back, but he sent a section down here. So if you just use that two guns of Caliph as Reynolds' section, then you get an idea of where the suction was. The enemy was moving down the Hagerstown Pike on my left to cut me off from Gettysburg. And because they were going to flank me, I gave the order to fall back, and the troops slowly retired in the direction of the seminary. The fighting was so obstinate as they moved off that the enemy's pursuit was cautious and tardy, reaching the barricade near the seminary. Now, the barricade has been built by Gabriel Paul's brigade of Robinson's division, who would be sent to the north, but they did throw up a semi-circular barricade around in front of the seminary. The enemy advanced in heavy lines across the field in front, and when they got to within a short range, we opened on them with such an effect that they retired over the ridge. They soon, however, advanced again in greater force, the right of their lines extending across the Hagerstown Road and sweeping around our entire left. Now, who's coming in the second time down here? You beat them back the first time? Pedigree was the first one? Another whole division. William Dorsey Pendle is coming in. So with new men coming in, that is why they are so overlapping. Now let's talk about the 121st PA. 121st PA is one right here to your left. A large body of the enemy's troops had been seen to the west of our position throughout the day. While we were taking up a position facing to the north to support a battery at the corner of the woods, these troops were seen advancing. The battery at the corner of the woods was Reynolds, remember, when he turned back and faced north. We were then ordered to form to meet them and change front to that effect. As the proper position assigned to the 121st was immediately in front of the battery, the left section of Reynolds, we were moved to the extreme left with the 20th New York State Militia on our right. I saw the line of the enemy slowly approaching up the hill, extending far beyond our left flank, for which we had no defense. As the enemy's faces appeared over the crest of the hill, we fired effectually into them, but soon after received a crushing fire from their right, under which our ranks were broken and became massed together as we endeavored to change front to the left to meet them. The attack on our front was destroyed by our first fire, but the left is what kills them, and as you heard, they go back to the focus. Pedigree. 52nd North Carolina. 52nd, 47, 11, 26. About noon, we advanced, and Pedigree's brigade encountered the enemy in an open field and a most desperate fight ensued. We moved. We're off by about what? 3 hours? Okay. Colonel Marshall's regiment held the right of Pedigree's line. That's the 52nd. And as we advanced through the open field on our right flank was menaced by a body of the enemy cavalry seeking an opportunity to charge us. I told you later that Buford will do gallant duty down here. Gamble's brigade will just completely stop this whole right flank. While on the advance and under heavy fire, Colonel Marshall formed the regiment into a square to guard against the attack from this body, and at the same time deployed Company B under Lieutenant Kyle to protect this flank. This gallant officer succeeded in holding the cavalry in check and finally drove them from our flank. This maneuver was executed as promptly and accurately as if on the drill grounds. Well, guess what? Buford never wanted to attack. He only was feigning so that he could delay the attack. 47th North Carolina. 47th would be probably right out by the barn, okay? If the 52nd is down by the road, the 47th is the next one in. We crossed the stream and then up a hill and through a wheat field. And then in our front, about 75 yards off, we see the heavy lines of the Yankee soldiers with their guns shining and the flags waving. The struggle goes hotter and hotter. Men were falling in every direction, but the 47th and the 52nd are pushing the enemy steadily back and are going forward. The 26th and the 11th are contending with heavy odds, both to numbers and positions, because our brigade's in the woods, okay? While the 47th and the 52nd have the foe in the open field, the 26th and the 11th have nothing to shelter themselves any more than we have. And thus it is that the 52nd and the 47th, having driven back the enemy in their front, their lines begin to swing around to the left. So they'll begin to flank who is up here. 52nd will kind of move forward, the 47th is beginning to flank. Now, as everybody starts to go back, Colonel Chapman Biddle never gets credit, but he sure is one hell of a man, because he rallies the 142nd, and he makes a charge back into them to try to delay them. Just then, a federal officer came into view and rode rapidly forward bearing a large federal flag. The scattered Federals swarmed around him as bees cover their queen. In the midst of this heterogeneous mass of men, acres big, he approached our left with all the guns in front. And from our right and left, with all the guns in front, and from our right and left, turned on the mass and seemingly shot the mass to pieces. So the counterattack failed. But it did do one thing, it that time, so that guys could go back. Now, this guy is named Captain John T-H-R-O-P, Thorpe. The hero was Colonel Biddle, who, if he were otherwise competent, deserved to command a brigade, deserved to command a corps. It was with genuine and openly expressed pleasure but our men heard that he was not killed. And you hear this a number of times in the battle. Now, any questions down here? What happens down here? They move around about 5 or 6 different places. Pettigrew comes in, flanks them. They retire, small counter charge, but the left just keeps coming. They move towards the seminary, hit the barricades, get driven back, and as they get driven back, Pender comes up and takes their place. Okay?
What artillery is out here?
Pretty Confederate.
McIntosh has now come up, and you got two reserve battalions, McIntosh and Peeble.
So that would be what? One of the 24th has a cannonball exploding on their monument. Is that from those guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to the west. It's, the artillery will be shooting up here from roads.
Well, that's what I was saying before. Of course, it came from out there. Well, that wouldn't be right. Well, that's far, and that time doesn't match up.
It's not that they can't shoot. It's that if you read roads, roads is aiming at the guys up on the road. Although, you should not have to have done it. So if it did come from up there, it would have to be an overshot. And that's pretty good of an overshot. So, right?
Well,
by the time, let me just add the last piece here. By the time this is coming Daniel is approaching the railroad cut, and Carter has been pulled off, and Fry is advancing right behind Rhodes' men, so they were not shooting at that point. They got themselves into the road, and therefore they were out of the fire until Pettigrew started to move. Okay, what made him come up here and turn? But Pettigrew's advance. And by Pettigrew's advance, Daniel is coming down. Carter is wrecked. Carter is literally wrecked. And he is driven, he is taken to the left to fight against the 11th Corps. And Fry is moving right in behind Ramsey. So, baffled that it's a shell from up here.
How far did Biddle's counterattack at 142nd get? Did it get down to Willoughby Run?
I would say right up about here.
What, from the seminary to about?
Not even to seminary. They start to pull back and you get them probably out of there in the open field behind and charge them up. Like, remember, they talk about area of maybe 10 or 20 feet. And when you read it, you don't know it's 10 or 20 feet because they don't say 10 or 20 feet. But things are much more localized than you would believe. And I can only say again about what a number of people, Carol Reardon, said it real well in her book about Pickett's Charge. And Chamberlain says it too. People talk about what happens in front of them, okay? And 5 feet away, something else is happening to somebody else, and we'll give you a completely different story, and yet you're only 5 feet away from each other. So distance is not major distances, okay? When you write about it, you want it to be, because you want to be a hero, okay? But compress things, okay? It's the same logic I use for Wilkinson. Right? Everybody wants to do something big when the chances are you don't shoot Reynolds as somebody aims at him. It's a straight bullet that whacks him. Questions down here.
I think I'm from 151st Pennsylvania at the edge of the woods.
Yes. There's been Reynolds per day. If you remember, two regiments were pulled towards the grove as the other two went on when they were coming back from the Hagerstown Pike. About 2 p.m., 151st Volunteers was detached by General Rowley and ordered to take a position behind a fence running at the south end of the seminary grove. Where's the grove, John? Up there?
There was a grove to the left.
To the left of the seminary. Shortly after this, it occupied a temporary breastworks made of rail stumps that was put by the 2nd Brigade of the 2nd Division through the west edge of the grove and parallel with the ridge. By this time, the line of battle was forming in our front, which is Biddle coming back up, and you have the Iron Brigade here. In this line, there was a gap or interval immediately in our front between the balance of our brigade and General Meredith's brigade. Into this interval, the 151st Pennsylvania was ordered by General Rowley in person, and crossing the breastworks behind which it lay, we advanced and closed into the interval. This was happening. It takes them a while to get across the field, doesn't it? And by that time, the fight had already started. So the 151st is moving into position. And now we're going to walk down and talk about the Iron Brigade and the 26th and the 11th. So they're coming forward. Just remember, they'll be here. And that would be the 142nd, which you see the cross over here, and the 151st. I want you to notice, there's the ridge.
down near the 19th Indiana Monument.
That's low ground, isn't it? Look out here. You walk right up there where that blue car is, you come out right where the John and the barn is. So, if you call that West McPherson, then it's going to end right down about here. And this is the ridge that they keep talking about. If we stand up there, it looks like we're on the ridge, when in fact, there's the ridge. And this really kind of blew my mind when I came down here and I realized this. So when the 7th is making the charge into the ravine, you can now see it. And then I haven't walked down here yet, so I don't know if it bends back out or not, but this is the ravine. Okay? Now, let's read about the 26th, which is probably down there to some extent. They are the biggest regiment on the field, the 26th, 843 men. They will take on the 24th Michigan, but they'll also take on the right wing of the 19th Indiana, and then when everybody gets pushed back, they will also hit the 151st PA. 26th, Major Jones. In front of the 26th was a wheat field, about one-fourth of a mile wide. Then a stream thick with underbrush and briars along the banks, and beyond this was another open field and a wooded hill directly in front of the 26th position. Where's the open field? Both. Skirmishers were thrown out. They remained in the line of battle until about 2 p.m. Ordered to advance, the brigade moved forward at foot time in conjunction with Black and Brass Brigade on their left. On reaching the stream, the enemy poured into the left flank of the brigade a heavy fire from the opposite bank where they had massed in heavy numbers. The brigade moved across the stream and up the opposite slope, driving the enemy in front at the point of the bayonet back upon his second line. What do you think? I think he probably took on the skirmishers and drove them back to the main line. The second line was engaged by the 26th. On the second line, the fighting was terrible. The two lines stood no farther than 20 paces apart and delivered volleys into each other. Finally, the enemy gave way and reformed in the woods. We walked across these woods, haven't we? When we first came out, if you notice, it was not very far in there before we went down and up to a little high ground and then went down again to the ridge behind us. So if you were the Union troops, you would probably fall back through that little low ground to the high ground on the other side. They were again driven from this third position, losing a stand of colors taken by the 26th. The colors were left behind, however, and were picked up by somebody else. The 26th did not get orders to fall back and started to collect ammunition from the enemy's dead. As they prepared to advance, General Pender's division passed over them and took up the attack. The 26th followed and helped in driving the enemy from the ridge at the edge of town. They then halted and the brigade bivouacked in the woods they had occupied before the attack, back up on her route. One thing that amazed me, 843 men went into this attack for the 26th, in 45 minutes we'll lose 580, but they don't stop when Iron Brigade is driven from the trees. They move with Pender into the attack on Seminary Ridge, which is quite a feat. And that's something I didn't know until I started to do the reference with this. Let's start from the left. When they were pulled back, the 24th Michigan, which had been on the left, was now moved to the center, and the 19th now took its place on the left. Up on the right, the 7th had taken the place of the 2nd. So we'll start down here with the 19th Indiana, which is right here in front of us, spread out there. At 3 o'clock, the enemy attacked this position, coming forward in three lines of battle. Where's the third line come from? Unless they're talking about the skirmishers, the I have no idea where that third line came from. Far overlapping me on the left, in addition to a flanking column whose intention evidently it was to sweep around my left and rear, thus subjecting my command to capture. They want to get around behind me. My regiment was in line and ready for action from the moment the enemy's advance was seen. As soon as I came in range, I ordered the men to open on them, which was done. The fire was immediately returned. My regiment held its position until we had suffered severely from the front, as well as from the column on the left, until 20 of my men lay dead and 100 wounded. Finding it impossible to hold the position against such overwhelming force, the line commenced retiring, firing with good effect while it did so. 100 yards in the rear, I halted and reformed the line, but again were forced to retire. A few rods in the rear of this line was a fence partially torn down, behind which the second time I reformed the line again, my right now resting on the 7th Wisconsin. The front of my left was broken and forced to retire after a severe loss, and it was here exposed to a deadly flank fire as they went back. Right. See if you're all putting it together. Those generals already has broken in as they try to get back. In comes the Confederates from the left. Now, let's just go back here. 100 yards in the rear, I halted and reformed the line. Where would that be? It would be where I reformed, okay? My ground, okay? The ropes that we have been talking about constantly about. And they are broken in forms a little bit on, so what I would say from one end of the ridge to the other end of the ridge is probably where the fence was. I don't know if you have a fence up there, John, on the ridge. As the enemy gained the crest of the ridge, now in front, they sustained a deadly fire from our guns, but they were 3 or 4 to our 1, and we were now too weak to avail anything against our crowds. Retiring from here, I placed the remnant of my command behind a barricade of logs and rails, pistols and muskets at the commencement of the fight. The barricade back at the seminary. Fourth Michigan. We had inflicted severe loss on the enemy, but the numbers were so overpowering and our losses so great that we were unable to maintain our position and were forced back step by step, contesting every foot of ground to the barricade. I was wounded just before reaching the barricade west of the seminary buildings and left the field. 7th Wisconsin. second Wisconsin and seventh. The front line of the end, well, let's march up to the second. Let's go.
Row 26, North Carolina.
Colonel Morrow of the 24th Michigan and Robinson of the 7th, here out in front, did not like the position. And they thought that they had should have been moved back to the ridge. They have gone twice, probably to Solomon Meredith, the brigade commander, and asked to be repositioned back there. And this is what Morrow of the 24th said. The woods were shelled and I had no casualties to report at this time. I sent officers several times to the general commanding to report the condition of the line and suggested a change of position, as in my judgment, this position was untenable. To these reports of the condition of my line, I received the answer that the position was ordered to be held and must be held at all hazards. So, Meredith or Doubleday, somebody is telling him, stay put. But the guys on the front line, and I thought that was most amazing to me, they took out that this place is not the place to fight. And one of the reasons is because the left is open. And they talked about two regiments coming up on their ridge behind them, but not being able to hold. And what is going to kill them down here? They got flanked again to the ridge and then got flanked another time up on the ridge. So we can do it from here because we can see the second Wisconsin. My voice is going. The front line of the enemy with skirmishers advanced directly in our front, while the second line advanced obliquely to the left. That would probably be Brackenbrow going to the left. In a short time, the enemy skirmishers and our own became actively engaged, which continued with great spirit for some time. When it was discovered, an attempt was made to flank our position by the second line, and an order was given to fall back towards the seminary, and in that seminary directly in our rear, at which place was placed the 5th Maine Artillery. The movement was made in good order, firing as we retired. About half the distance from where we commenced to retire, a new position was formed. I faced the regiment to the front and again moved to meet the advancing columns of the enemy when I discovered the enemy closing upon our left. I again faced to the rear and took up my position on the ridge referred to, on the right of the brigade, which was already in position. At this time and point, the battle raged with great fury until near the close, of which I received a severe gunshot in the left leg. 7th Wisconsin. About the same time, I discovered that the enemy had gained our left and rear. Keep hearing the same thing over and over again, don't you? The left is broken and the break is coming from Chapman Biddle's area, which is going to force everybody back. And as soon as that happens, the 11th North Carolina Pettigrew can also get into the attack in flank. Soon after, a small detachment was brought from some other division to attack this force coming from the left. But it was too small a detachment and was soon repulsed. Who's he talking about? Biddle. Who was back at the seminary and brought forward? 151st. Because he's up here, 7th Wisconsin. That's where he can see Biddle, but he can see the 151st. The troops on our left have fallen back. The 24th and 19th on the left of the brigade were being cut up by superior numbers. The 2nd and the 7th were keeping up a rapid fire upon the enemy in the front, but I think without doing him much injury, as he was protected by the hill and the timber. He was rapidly gaining our left, and still no order came to change our position. The 7th was receiving a galling fire, and the 2nd was being badly cut up when finally Captain Richardson of the brigade staff wrapped me in order to retire to the seminary. So what breaks the Iron Brigade? The whole fight here in the afternoon is summed up by one thing. They overlap the left, cave in the left, forcing Biddle back, and now, like the dominoes, it's going to fall right up here, and one regiment after the other kept telling you the same thing. The left was turned, the left was turned, the left was turned, and piece by piece they have to pull out, and as they do, they now got to meet the fire of the guys who are driving and flanking as they try to get back into the low ground. Okay? We're now going to walk up and do the last part, which is stone, and take a John break, because I got to go. So, it happens when you get old. So. Any questions before we move on? There are some rises as you go to her ridge. Easiest way to see that is to drive it, and as you're driving, just look off to the left, and there are little
stop at the quarry at the run.
Which one they call the hill where we stopped, who knows? But the thing that made them really stop is, as they were going back and up the hill, Rock and Brow and Pettigrew were advancing to try to fortify Archer and Davis and stop the stuff. The other thing I didn't mention is when the Iron Brigade was brought back, their first position was facing to the north. They formed that way. Davis is pushing them, right? So they don't know that the charge is coming at the railroad cut and everything is solidified over there. So when you come back, you've got to protect your flank, and therefore you form here temporarily and then swing back. And Tim says the same thing. If you take it anything with Tim, you'll have them facing north also. Very, very short. Because they didn't hear that the right flank is taken care of. Okay? Now we can go. Doubleday's division, the first is trapped in Biddle. Biddle was put on the south. Roy Stone is up here to try to connect the 2nd Brigade, which is Kepler, with the Iron Brigade, the 1st Brigade in the trees. Comes over from the seminary having stacked backpacks. As we came upon the field, the enemy opened fire on us with two batteries from the opposite ridge and continued it with some intermission during all of the action. Our ridge afforded slight shelter from this fire, but no better was attainable. Our first disposition was unchanged until between 12 and 1, when a new battery upon a hill on the extreme right opened on us a most destructive enfilade fire. And at the same time, all the troops upon my right fell back a half a mile to the seminary. Who's the troops falling back? Kepler's brigade, who has come back out to the ridge and can sustain the enfilade fire. This made my position hazardous and difficult in the extreme, but rendered its maintenance of this area all the more important. I threw one regiment, the 149th PA, Lieutenant Colonel Dwight commanding, into the road and disposed the others on the left of the stone building to conceal them from the artillery in fallout fire. My line thus formed a right angle facing north and west. 149th is right out there. Okay? 143rd behind the barn. The 150th to the left of the house, which is no longer here, but it would be out there. Shortly after, as the enemy's infantry was deployed in heavy force upon my right, I sent another regiment, the 143rd Pennsylvania, to the right of the 149th. If you go out there, look down, right by the road where we just were, is between the two trees, the 143rd shaking his fist. About 1:30 p.m., the grand advance of the enemy's infantry began. From my position, I was able to trace their formation for at least 2 miles. It appeared to be nearly a continuous line of deployed battalions with other battalions masked in reserve. Their line being formed not parallel but oblique to ours, their left became engaged with the troops on the northern prolongation of the Seminary Ridge. That would be Rhodes attacking Baxter and Paul. That's next week. The battalions engaged soon took a direction parallel to those opposed to them, and this caused a break in their line and thus exposed their flank to our fire of the two regiments on the Chambersburg Pike. Now, Stone must have been drunk. Absolutely. Because he says, though at the longest range of our pieces, we poured a most destructive fire upon their flanks, together with the fire from their front, scattered them over the fields. I can tell you, if you can hit them, you're left, let alone do any damage to them. A heavy force would then form in two lines parallel to the Chambersburg Pike and pressed forward to the attack of my position. Anticipating this, I sent Colonel Dwight and the 149th PA forward to occupy a deep railroad cut about 100 yards from the road. We were just out there looking at the railroad cut earlier today. And when they came to a fence within pistol shot of his line, he gave them a staggering volley. Where was the fence? It's the fence that the 147th bent their right back behind. Reloading as they climbed the fence and waiting till they came within 30 yards, he gave them another volley and then charged them, driving them back over the fence in confusion. Returning to the cut, he found that the Confederates had placed a battery in an orchard, but perfectly enfiladed the railroad cut. Now, the guy I've brought this with numerous times from Lebanon, Rich Gore, I'm telling you, is a superior guy. If you ever get a chance to take anything from Rich Gore, please do yourself the favor and take it. But we were trying to determine where that orchard and the line would be, and we saw high ground out here, but that doesn't infiladed the left line. So the only thing I can conclude is right at the base of Her Ridge, there had to be an orchard so that you could shoot right down. So let's use Her Ridge, shooting right down the railroad cut. Colonel Dana of the 143rd PA had meanwhile been engaged with the enemy directly in his front and prevented them from outflanking Colonel Dwight on the right. And Colonel Wister had been holding his original line, now the left front. Stone was wounded about this time, and he says he can't talk anymore about the battle. And he turns it over to Colonel Worcester of the 150th PA, who assumed command of the brigade. But Worcester would be wounded a short time later, and finally Colonel Dana takes over the brigade. Let's talk about the 141st. Now, let's walk out across the road where we were, because that was fairly quiet.
We're back at the Rouse Monument, on the wrong pike.
Here's what he's going to talk about, Colonel Dana. The painting, and by the way, you can see the ridge now behind the barn. Let me make a point. There was a lane that came in, but you can still see a part of it right in front of the barn, the McPherson barn lane. The painting, the crest of a ridge or a slope, a line was formed to the right and somewhat in advance of the 1st Brigade. Who was the 1st Brigade? Butler is the 2nd Brigade. Iron Brigade, Meredith. They're in the trees, so he's a little bit in front, he says. The 150th was on the left. The 143rd in the center, the 149th on the right. The 150th and 130 of 143rd occupied the interval between a grove of woods on the left, near which General Reynolds was killed, and a barn and a stone dwelling on the right. Now the 149th was formed on an extension of the line to the right of the barn between it and the railroad. That's incorrect. It can't be out to the railroad site. It's got to be maybe on this side of the road, but it can't be pushed all the way out there. The troops occupied this position for a short time under a fire of round shot and shell when the enemy's advance, preceded by skirmishers, was discovered. And at the same time, artillery fire was opened on our right. Look right up, you can see Oak Ridge. Company D of the 150th Volunteers under Captain Jones, Company A of the 143rd under Captain Hanahan, and Company K of the 149th under Captain Johnson were deployed to the front as skirmishers and soon became warmly engaged. That's down there because they haven't turned yet. Later in the day, Company E of the 149th under Colonel McCullough was detached for leg duty, and these four companies under their gallant officers were employed in this service during the early part of the engagement until forced back by overwhelming numbers. The attack upon our right became so severe that a partial change of front was necessary, and the 143rd and the 149th, under a severe fire, was formed into a line facing the right and at a right angle with the first line formed along the road, which runs parallel and the distance of 100 yards from a railroad cut. Get a pretty clear picture, can't you? The 143rd took position to the right of the 149th. The 150th retained its original position, but merely redeployed to occupy the space between the grove and the barn, which had up to this point been occupied by the 143rd. This movement had scarcely been completed when the enemy advanced against our entire front in large numbers, and when within easy range, they were received with an effective fire from our whole line, which threw them into confusion, and a charge by the 149th forward to the railroad cut was made, chasing them back to a sheltered position. Where's the sheltered position? right there on the other side of that high ground where the fence runs right along the top of it. We're back over the fence. Well, they reformed their broken ranks, and at about this time, Colonel Stone of the 149th and Worcester of the 150th, having been wounded, I took command of the brigade. The contest became severe, and three successive attacks against our line were repulsed, in which we sustained heavy losses in killed and wounded. But the enemy evidently, from numbers left on the ground after each repulse, suffered even more severely. The brigade went into position at about 11 a.m., became engaged about noon, and the conflict endured until about 4 o'clock, when a more heavy advance by the enemy was made and again checked by a well-directed fire. But the support built upon our right and our left, and withdrawn, superior numbers enabled the enemy to extend his lines and threaten both of our tracks. Now, 11 o'clock is right. Around here, around 11 to 11:30. Should they become engaged at 12? Absolutely not. Probably 2:30. This would be a good likely time, I would say. How long did they fight out here? 3:30, about an hour. But you hear the same thing all over again. What forces them out? The left flank is given away, and the right flank, which is next week Rhodes, will be winning up there, and therefore the last troops to leave McPherson's Ridge will be Stone's Brigade of the Pennsylvania, and two of the regiments are called the Bogus Bucktails, but after this fight they won't be called Bogus anymore, okay? Facing to the rear, the line was withdrawn in good order some distance towards town where it was halted, and seven volleys were fired at the advancing enemy. Moving fence nearer to town to a peach orchard at the seminary, not far from where the railroad embankment begins, the brigade halted, and together with a portion of battery of artillery, all the parties that had become separated from their regiments renewed the fight. The supply of ammunition, 60 rounds per man, having been exhausted, was here replaced, and they expended it in trying to defend the seminary. Now we get into some real stuff. Lieutenant Colonel Dwight. During this time, after getting into position on the pike, in accordance with Colonel Stone, I directed my regiment to fire over the heads of my skirmishers at the enemy about one-third of a mile distance on the brow of a hill.
From the Oak Hill.
We were then massing in large force preparatory to a general advance on our right and on the 11th Corps, which was stationed across the roads to our right and rear. And you see the 11th Corps. This was written in September of 1863. So he would have known by this time where the 11th Corps was, but you physically can't see the 11th Corps from here. So the only thing you could see was the attack of Rhodes, because you couldn't even see them massing, because they massed behind the tree line. In the meantime, the enemy, who had been massing on our right, made a furious advance on the 11th Corps in large force, and at the same time moved on my front with one brigade of three regiments. That's the important point. Three regiments. Who are they? Gander Brigade, 37th, 2nd North Carolina Battalion, and what is the other one? 43rd? 45th? Okay. 47th is up here in Bender's Lane. Okay, and then 53rd is sent over. Okay. Colonel Stone ordered me to move my regiment forward and take possession of the railroad cut about 50 paces to my front. Also, to plant my colors on the left bank, left flank of the regiment. All which was accomplished in good order while the enemy were moving over the low ground between the two positions. That's important because that means Daniel doesn't see the forward movement. Look right over there. Once you get off that ridge, you are blind until you come up to the fence. Consequently, our change of position was unknown to the enemy. My skirmishers were gradually driven in, and when they were, I ordered them to take a position on the right of the regiment. My men being deployed in a single line in the cut, with their arms resting on the bank, and with deliberate orders to take aim at the knees of the front rank of the enemy as he came up. My position was undiscovered by the enemy until he reached a rail fence 22 yards in my front. And when he saw my colors flying, where's the colors? He ordered his 1st Regiment to fire at the colors. Its effect on the fire on the colors. I now ordered my regiment to fire by battalion, and its effect on the enemy was terrible. At this time, they were in brigade mass, and they broke to the rear in great confusion. Back over the fence line they go. In the meantime, I ordered my regiment to reload. And when the enemy advanced a second time and made a most desperate effort to carry my position by assault, in which we handsomely repulsed him by reserving our fire until he almost reached us with our muzzle pieces, he let go of volley and again he fell back. The fight was of most desperate courage, we losing heavily and the enemy's gun and wounded completely covered the ground in our front. At this stage of the contest, during the heat of the fight in our front, the enemy had planted 3 or 4 pieces of artillery in an orchard on our left, at about a half a mile distance, commanding the cut I occupied, and then also under the cover of the hill under which we were fighting, succeeded in moving a regiment upon my left flank. The 32nd, which is Colonel Gravel, 32nd North Carolina, when Daniel figures he can't take it from the front, Gravel is sent down, crosses the cut, which would be down near Davis's Mississippians, where is Davis, down there in the tree line, and will be trying to come around on the flank. I discovered all this in time, saved my regiment by moving it rapidly back to its 1st position on the pike. But I regret to inform you, not in time to save our colors, which were still where I had planted them, 20 paces to the left flank of the regiment. The color guard, all being killed or wounded while defending them. To have saved my colors would have been to advance between two forces of the enemy, both superior in numbers to my own. Also, to have put the command under an enfilade fire from a battery. It would have been certain destruction. I saved the regiment from lost the colors. Isn't that grand? And it's absolutely not true at all. Where the colors are, were planted right down in the wheat. Not in the left of the regiment, which is up here at the railroad cut, but in the middle of that field.
No 20 paces, it was a lot more than that.
No 20 paces, right. It was about 100 yards, and there's a lot of writings about where it was. And Rich, who comes from Lebanon, and the color company comes from Lebanon, and all the guys are buried up in Lebanon, okay, has done great research and I've brought this with him. And he thinks it's not even here. The historians think it is, which is like right out here past the trees, about maybe 20 yards away from the railroad cut and away from the road, but down over the slope. The logic he uses, I would walk you down there except look what's down there today. I thought all of the stuff has grown up.
Well, I'm speaking of Rich.
Try over there.
Around the corner there. We'll just a couple people.
I said is a superior guy on the field.
The check is in the mail.
Anyway, Rich's argument is
Rich Core, Killer HR.
You can only see the top of the tower. You can talk about the fight for the colors of the. If you're right here where everybody has them, you can see the barn and you can see the retreat, but why would you be still out here when the regiment is retreating? But if you're just maybe another 30 feet down, you lose sight of the barn all except for the path. So that's where Rich has them, a lot farther to the west than they normally think. But still, not on the left of the regiment, and certainly back from the railroad cut, probably halfway from the road to the cut. Okay? Now. The 143rd, during all this movement, remained in position on the road. But now they're poured into the enemy and are advancing on their front at vigorous fire. The 150th, to the left, still held its original position, although fighting at desperate odds. And who they would be fighting would be Rock and Brass Brigade, and I'm not sure that you would call it at desperate odds, because Brockenbrough doesn't seem to push very heavily here in the fight. Colonel Langhorn Whiston of the 150th PA now commanded the brigade. The enemy in the meantime broke over the hill partially to our front and flank. Who's that? Colonel Bravel in the 32nd North Carolina. He says they're coming straight for the barn. Whereupon, they received a reception at our hands and the right wing of the 150th, and they retired with heavy loss. Not sure it's the 149th, but it is the right flank of the 150th, and Lieutenant Colonel Patty Cooper will win the Medal of Honor in this attack against the 32nd as they're coming up on an oblique. We again occupied our original position, but were fearfully decimated with both officers and men, and not having much at this time more than one half the number we went into the engagement with. The 150th was as badly off as ourselves, all its field officers being compelled to leave the field with severe wounds. Now, my voice is gone and I'm not. The 150th will bend out companies on the right of the regiment, and they will form on the left of the 149th. As Daniel begins to come in a second time, Whisper tells them, the 149th, to make a second charge out into the railroad cut. They do drive Daniel back, but as they do, 42nd Mississippi, Bravo, and the battery starts to enfilade their line, and this second charge definitely should not have been made. They no more than get to the railroad cut, then back they have to come because the fire is too hot. Now, when the 150th bent to three companies and Bravo started to come up, what's in front of them but the flags of the 149th? It looks like there's a whole regiment there. And so that is going to confuse Bravo, and he's going to try to give it some wide berth and come over probably by the road. And as he's coming up, Hattie Cooper and Worcester leads the charge. Worcester's from Philadelphia, swings the three regiments out and charges down to the left of the road and into Bravo and drives Bravo back down the hill. And for that, Hattie Cooper gets the Medal of Honor. Worcester is wounded, taken off the field. Hattie Cooper is wounded, will stay on the field. Back in line, Daniel begins to push again. And now the line begins to break because, Stone told you, troops on the right have fallen back, troops on the left have fallen back. You got Pettigrew coming in from the front. You got Brackenbrough, whoever is there from Brackenbrough in the front, begins to push. And so the 150th is pushed back through the barn, through the field, to the barricades as the 149th starts to pull back and the 143rd. Who haven't I pulled back yet? Who's still out here in the middle of the field? The flags of the 149th. This is the point the bridge makes. If you're right up here past the trees, you can see the pullback. If you're down 30 more feet, you only see the top of the barn. The reason the flags were put out there was to try to get the artillery from Burr Ridge to fire at the flags. When they turned on the road, they were protected from the north by a ditch that ran along the side of the road. They could lay in the ditch and be protected. But the left company of the 149th is seen as they're swinging around. And that's all the artillerymen need to know, where the left went, because you can assume the rest of the regiment is in a straight line from it. So they have begun to enfilade the line, and Stone comes up with the idea, take two flags, place them out here, make them think there's a regiment out here, and the artillery fell for it and started to shoot at six guys behind a rail fence that they piled up the fence to hide behind. The fence was kind of like north and south. Six guys hiding down their heads with the flags in the air. These flags, he was nuts to win the first place fight as anything else, because it's going to completely tie up this area, because with two flags, what's supposed to be near them? The whole regiment. We've already seen Daniel comes down, sees the flags, and left over with the valley at the flags, which doesn't hit anybody but the flags. Bravo has bypassed them. Now, as Brackenbrough comes in, Bravo comes back in. Bravo probably is over on the east side, south side of the road for the final push, as the other Daniel regiments come in at the railroad cut. Right out there is two flags. And the 42nd Mississippi, down in the trees, were supposed to form the reserve line. And as everybody came in, as you got closer and closer, the line from Daniel and Rockenbrow would close. And then the 40, the Davis would fall in behind it. They'll go with them. So they haven't moved. But they're looking at these clouds, and they're trying to figure out what the hell is going on. Because as Rockenbrow comes up, what is supposed to happen? The regiment would turn and fire into the flank and stop Rockenbrow. But guess what? Nothing's happening. So what are these two flags doing out there? What you saw down there in the tree line? Looking at these two flags. Well, finally, Sergeant Frank Price says, I can't take it anymore. And starts to run, literally, towards the flag. Figures, I guess, that there's nobody there. He is joined by two men from the 2nd Mississippi and three men from his own regiment. And hiding behind the rail fence are the flag bearers. Guy is a real hero. Henry Brehm, B-R-E-H-M. And he has been taking nothing but crap from the other guys who are telling him, hey, let's get the hell out of here and get back. But he says, our duty is to stay where we were placed until we receive orders, and we haven't received orders. But he has allowed a man by the name of Hoffman to go back and find out whether we should move back. Hoffman gets back there, can't find anybody because all the field officers are down, and by the time he finally finds Colonel Dana, the break has already come and he can't get back. And he says to go back with the been captured. So they kiss these guys goodbye because they figure they're going to get captured. So in the meantime, the five remaining men are back here behind the fence line listening to all this stuff happening around them, but nobody's sitting right there where they are. So here comes through the week Frank Price and the other six Confederates. Now, another guy from Daniel writes that they snuck through the wheat, but Price himself says he made a dash right through the wheat, so I got to believe the guy that was in charge. Now as they near the flags, the Confederates make a mistake, because being a Confederate, I know this for heart, you can't do anything without first giving the old good rebel yell. And as soon as they give the rebel yell, it alerts the guys behind Bream, Hammer, Fidel, Raymond, and Spade. Jump up, let go with a volley, because they got the guns. The Mississippians didn't expect it, and almost all of them immediately went down. Now we got the comedy of errors. Raymond is carrying the state flag. Bream is carrying the national flag. As Bream and Lehman jump up, Lehman hits Bream and falls to the ground. A Confederate, before he's shot, grabs the flag, and Lehman grabs the other flag, and they got this tug of war over this rail fence. But about the same time, another Confederate gets on the fence and sticks his musket right in Lehman's neck, and Lehman pushes it away with one hand. Here we are. And then he hears a firing, a shot, and the gun falls away. And he looks around, and Spade is behind him, having shot the Confederate. Spade grabs the flag and takes off. But as he mounts up right about here, about to your right, what do you see? Don't see blue, do you? So he says, whoops. And he goes this way, followed by Lehman. Both get shot, but both fell down near the railroad track, and a Confederate, not Price, wraps up, picks up the flag, and takes it back. In the meantime, Ream is fighting probably Price, and they're having a tug of war over the fence too. And finally, Ream lets go of the flag and grabs Price by the neck and lunges, and as he lunges, he knocks Price on his back and comes down on top of him, and that kind of knocks Price out. Green picks up the flag, and up he comes, but he doesn't go this way, he keeps going this way. Price gets up, picks up his musket, and tries to follow Lehman, but he will say, I don't shoot him. I got within 10 feet of him when I was ready to shoot him. Both of the guys got hit by somebody else, and I didn't want to pick up the flag because I figured somebody will pick it up and give it to me back in my company. And so he goes into fight. Green up here takes a look. He's behind Brackenbrow's brigade. What do you do? I think he got a pretty good idea. What Green decides to do is run like hell right through. The surprise of a Union guy coming through the ranks is probably going to really shock him, and they're not going to be able to react. And look, right back there is the seminary, and if I can get there, I'll be safe. Vassler, who wrote this whole account, who was the captain of the color company, is lying in the lane or by the fence, and he said, I can't move, but I can see all the action. I can move my head. And he says, and here comes Green. Boom! Right through the Confederates, down the slope, and almost up to East McPherson, when a shell fragment explodes and hits him in the chest, and down he goes. From the 55th Virginia, a guy by the name of Lincoln, who wasn't even in the fight, was faster than a bunch of other Confederates of Virginians, and runs out and picks up the flag of the national flag of the 149th. And the last they saw, of Bream is being marched back with this chest wound. He will die in Philadelphia on August the 9th, and in front of him was the Confederate carrying the flag. And he said these guys were the bravest guys of anybody out here because they wouldn't leave their position, and the two flags confused Daniels, confused Davis, and certainly confused probably the left of Brackenbrow, seeing these regiment out in the field, which we have to move around, when in fact it is six guys laying behind fence pilings with two flags. So there was the fight. Now, let me, anybody who's going to do Rich's walk for the Guide Association, Rich picked August the 9th, particularly because that's the day Green died. Now, again, with this piece, we can do it from here. The tender comes in. Everybody is falling back. Two seminary groups. They've got all the artillery lined up on the ridge behind the barricades. Anybody who can get there for the north is behind the barricades, and Pender comes in. On the extreme south, Lane's brigade moves past the road, and who do they run into? John Buford's cavalry, who again looks like it's going to charge, making the whole brigade form a square, takes one whole brigade out of the fight. Thomas's brigade is to the north of the road, over here behind us in support. On the road, down to the trees, is Scales' North Carolina Brigade. That's Pender's old brigade. And then Abner Perrin, McGowan's South Carolinian, is from the trees down towards where Biddle's brigade was fighting earlier in the day. Over here at the, what is this, the Larson Motel, was artillery Battery B under Stewart. Three guns to the north of the cup, three guns to the south. They turned the left three guns over at the seminary and faced south. And if you're Scales, you can understand why this happened. Where's the action? Over at the seminary. Where you're not going to be looking is to your left. So they get hit with three volleys of canister. Scales is wounded, and it's going to be right on the other side of the red light in the low ground where they get hammered. And so that whole brigade is broken. Total casualty loss is somewhere in the neighborhood of probably 600 to 700 men. That leaves Corinne himself to take Seminary Ridge. Four regiments go in. The first and the 14th towards the barricade, and 12th and 13th move towards the road and Buford. And the way they take the Seminary is they flank the Seminary Ridge line with the left two, the right regiments, and turn the left up the 121st, i.e. Biddle's men would fall back. Once they break them, they will start coming up towards the center, and that's going to relieve some of the pressure on the 14th and the 1st, and they will be able to make a break just to the south of the barricade, and then turn also and start up by the Seminary buildings. There is actually fighting around the Seminary. One group is on one side, one group's on the other side. But the Union is breaking from the south and coming up towards the center, towards the road. Stone's Brigade falls back and will protect that artillery, allowing it time to get off the field. And Kendall will always talk about, we could have captured all the artillery if we wouldn't have run into some troops behind the stone wall that took us some time to dislodge, and in the time they took to dislodge, the artillery was pulled out. So the 1st and 14th break the Seminary after the left was turned by the other two regiments, and everybody for the north pours over the hill. If you know regimental drill, the command was by the right of companies, that means each company is going to do something, to the rear, tells you which direction we're going, march. So each company just turned and came down on individual lines, because that's the quickest way out, rather than have a point where everybody marches to and then turns, which is a sure way to get beat. Everybody with me on that? Okay. Let me just end up with this. Battle of Gettysburg is won today. Day one. The defense of McPherson's Ridge and the defense of Oak Ridge by Baxter and Robinson's division. We've got the high ground out of it. The high ground will turn the fight on day two. Of course, Dan Sickles is trying to do something about that, give it back. But the high ground is what wins the battle. And let me make the main point. If you don't hold here on day one, you don't fight day two at Gettysburg. You're back at Pike Creek at Taneytown, Maryland, and therefore there won't, who knows what happens there. So 18,000 men, roughly, both sides, keep 28,000 Confederates out of town and away from the hills. And the guy to conceptualize this whole thing is not here, but you're sitting on his monument, John Reynolds, right on the ridges, so that we can fire back towards the high ground. It's not Buford in the movie, it's John Reynolds who conceptualized fighting on the west of town to fall back to the ridges. I'm done. I'll handle any questions you may have.
How far does Brackenbrow go?
Brackenbrow goes over to this, to the summit of Brackenbrow is part of the, probably down to the ridge and then comes back. Remember, he probably, they all talk over there at the barricade about defeating the first push, and then they came in stronger. So I'd say he probably got over the ridge and started to approach the Seminary and then came back.
And the reason they didn't go any further is?
The reason they didn't go any further is everybody was, remember, you got Pettigrew's pretty shot up by this time, and other than the 26th, everybody's going back to reform. Okay? It's amazing that Corinne does such a magnificent job in taking the Seminary Ridge line that something happened.